All right, if you've listened this far, you know the deal. The book that came out of this podcast is called How the Internet Happened, From Netscape to the iPhone by me, available wherever fine books are sold. Also, the podcast I do these days is called The Tech Meme Ride Home. Search any podcast app for Ride Home, and you should find The Tech Meme Ride Home, which is all the day's tech news every weekday in just 15 minutes. If you like this show, you'll love that one.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome to the Internet History Podcast. I'm your host, Brian McCullough. This is Chapter 5, Supplemental Episode 3. Oliver Knowlton is another one of our Pathfinder.com alumni. He's had a wide and varied career in media, from his role as the general manager of Sports Illustrated to his current role as the VP of the Digital Portfolio Group at Gannett. He's been working in various aspects of digital media for almost two decades now. Our previous Pathfinder interviewees have given us bookends of the Pathfinder story, both its origin story and its denouement, as it were. Oliver's discussion gives us a great summation of the story from someone who was there for the whole ride. So here's a fascinating conversation with Oliver Knowlton. Oliver Knowlton, thanks for coming on the Internet History Podcast.
Hi, Brian. How are you today?
Great. So can you give me a little bit of background before Time Warner? Are you in media and journalism before you get to Time?
I was actually started in a printing plant, working as a customer service rep for Time and People magazine, and I sort of moved up the food chain over the course of about 4 or 5 years. I ended up in a large pre-press facility at Time Inc., and then I got hired at Time Magazine to run their sort of printing operations and printing and binding. Mm-hmm. And then subsequently, I moved over to the editorial side of sort of their technology operations and technology guy. So I was doing things like getting the magazine onto QPS and desktop publishing and worrying about making sure the editors close the magazine on time and the early days of desktop publishing.
So you basically, you leapfrog your way up the chain, as it were. And so you find yourself eventually at Time Corporate.
I eventually find myself at Time Magazine, on the editorial side, working for some of the people that actually started thinking about the internet. And in my mind, that was a guy named Walter Isaacson, who we all know very well. And mm-hmm. Walter had just written an article on the World Wide Web that was really one of the first formative articles. I would say this is probably the late 80s, around 1990, you'll have to go back and check. But mm-hmm. And I just was so intrigued by it that I sort of, my radar went on, and I just said, this is something interesting. This is where the world's going. And he, I think, had aspired to be and he was an assistant managing editor at that time, and he had edited that story, which was just brilliant. And it almost looked like a web page. He had hypertext links off the side of the page, and it was just sort of giving people the first glimpse of what a web browser looked like, Mosaic, etc. And at that point in time, he had just been tapped by Jerry Levin, the then CEO of Time Warner to help build a television channel for the trial in Orlando that Jerry was sort of enamored with, which was a Switch Digital, you know, the first VCR, DVR experimentation with a bunch of SGI servers.
Right, the full service network.
Full service network, exactly. And so he partnered with a guy named Paul Sagan, who started New York One and was one of the youngest news editors there. And New York One was quite revolutionary in that they figured out how to essentially put on a newsreel, you know, create a news room and create a whole news environment for $10 million a year. So almost no cost, unheard of. And so Paul was really responsible for the technical operational execution, and Walter was going to be in charge of sort of the content and the editorial side of. And we were chartered with, these guys were chartered with building a news channel for this full service network. I at that point was just like, I don't know where this is going. I don't know what you're doing, Paul, Walter, but I'm coming with you. And so I just reached out to him, and there wasn't really a defined job. And I said, you know, let me be your operating guy and let me sort of figure out what you are thinking and where you want to go. And I wasn't very technical, and they hired some very smart news folks. And we started building this thing. We went out to California, and I think Walter was sort of, but the two of them were very quite shrewd in thinking that, you know, where's this sort of full service network going? We should also be thinking about the web. And so we talked to Andreessen and Jim Clark at Mosaic at that point. And we went up to Stanford and talked to folks at ARPANET. And we were just sort of exploring. And we found a company called Iconic Interactive in San Francisco. And they helped us build the software for this news channel. And it was essentially some content from CNN, and it was some content from Time Magazine. And what we sort of figured out how to do was build a essentially customized news channel with a lot of assets, an audio asset, a graphic asset, a text asset, and video assets. And we could essentially we'd have an anchor person read the news, and he or she when you're watching it, you could customize the news and say, I wanted to watch local, then sports, and then weather, et cetera, in any order you wanted. So it was sort of like this customized news channel on this beta test down in Orlando.
Did the channel ever go live on FSN?
What actually happened was we got it up and running, and what we quickly discovered is, you know, all they really had was just a massive room of SGI servers, and they essentially put lots and lots of movies on there, and that's all they could really handle. And so when we showed this to them, they said, you know, this is really great, this is incredible, but we have no idea how we are going to actually do this and scale this and build this. And subsequently, as we were starting to, you know, we had moved across the street from the Time Life building to the old FNN, Financial News Network, mm-hmm. Studio, which was literally directly across the street in the basement. And we took that over and created a newsroom, and we were prepared to start shooting, et cetera. And subsequently, we said, you know what we should do is we should start looking at building a website, and we should put up start grabbing some of the content from Time Inc. and start playing around in that space. And so another effort while we were building the news channel was going on to start building a website that subsequently became Pathfinder.
So the team that was putting together this channel is sort of the seed, the nucleus of what became the Pathfinder team?
That's exactly right. And what we started to do is hire some different kinds of people that understood how to, you know, in those days it was write Perl and to write some very rudimentary, even we were before Java, and just write some very rudimentary web applications. And we did a Derby site, and we built a garden site. And what started to happen is that the website continued to grow and flourish. And I remember bought a Cisco server, and there was literally no T1 line, no internet in the Time Life building, and we ended up putting a server in a conference room and really running a T1 line through the ceiling into the, you know, from the phone mm-hmm. and literally handcrafting this thing to get a server up. And there were many days when we had no firewall, and I mean, it was pretty clunky, but it was the beginning of something. And what we eventually did is we moved it across the street into the FNN and started building up a staff. And at the same time, I think it became apparent to Walter and Paul that we were never going to get this news channel off the ground, or it was never really going to be a scalable. The technology, not the technology that they had built, but the technology of this early days of DVR switch digital stuff, was we were just too far in front of it. So the effort started to swing the other way towards building a large website.
So is some of the motivation for this at the time, Time was also doing experimental deals with AOL. I spoke with Linda McCutcheon a few days ago. Was some of the thinking at this point that by going to the web, that Time could do some of the stuff it was doing with AOL, but they wouldn't have to have AOL as a middleman?
I don't recall that. What we started to do is when we built the site, you know, AOL wasn't so much in our radar at that point. We started putting a lot of effort behind it, thinking, you know, I think we had sort of the first portal, right? So we started building a lot of magazines, started putting up a lot of content sites. And so we started to get quite a bit of traffic, and we kept adding servers and boxes and sort of becoming slightly more professional. Although I have to say it was a little, rustic to say the least. You know, we really weren't, but we started to grow quite a bit of traffic. And then Walter and Paul started to say, you know, we have all of these different brands. We should call it something, not necessarily to, you know, hurt the brand or to hide the brand, but just to consolidate all of this traffic in under one hood, that where we can start to sell some advertising. And believe me, there was the idea of digital advertising back then was nascent. I mean, so we were significantly ahead of the game. I don't think AOL was, that acquisition, what wasn't a driver one way or the other. I know I'm certain that Walter was showing Pathfinder to the Jerry Levins of the world, and he was quite, you know, he liked technology, he liked new ideas. So mm-hmm. I'm certain that when we were building this thing and starting to show some success, and success is a relative word, we can have a conversation about that, but we when we started getting some traction, I'm sure that it did tickled Jerry's imagination and maybe was the beginning of some conversations with AOL. But I certainly wasn't privy to how much Pathfinder was a driver for a very bad marriage.
Right. So tell me a little bit about what the strategic idea is. Are there thinkings that is the thinking that maybe eventually you can put up a paywall and people will subscribe to, you know, read their favorite magazines and things like that?
I think we weren't that far, that forward thinking at that point. Mm-hmm. Walter at some point was then hired to become the managing editor of Time. So he peeled off and Paul became the real editor and CEO of the division. We became Time Inc. New Media at that point. The full service network efforts had sort of been shut down, and I think they declared victory that they got that test home up and running. And so we were just left with the studio really became dark, except for, more than 100 people, I guess, at that point, who were building and working with creating Pathfinder. And I think we still at that point felt as if we got enough mass that we would sell advertising to the site. I think that was really the original thought, and that we would grow the business and it would be an extension of the digital business, an extension of the print businesses. We were probably 5 or 6 years ahead of our time. I don't know what if that's 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, but we, you know, there was even the idea of banner ads were still a little bit early. And
right.
So, and the other thing is culturally, you know, early days, no one really cared so much about us having their digital brands. And so there wasn't a lot of infighting about, you know, who was selling it. And so we had some early sellers to try and, you know, get out and sell it. But, when you're in a place like Time Inc., which has got such strong brands, eventually it comes back, and people wanted to sort of own their own destiny. And so it started to become a very, you know, at one point Don Logan called it the $100 million hole, black hole.
Right.
And that was sort of the beginning of the end, where people started to question, like, what's going on here? And why, you know, they built this big early portal, and it's a content portal, and it was a news portal, but wasn't, no one could quite see the light at the end of the tunnel. And also there was a lot of criticism about the Pathfinder name. Why were we hiding our brands behind something called Pathfinder? And I, you know, that always used to annoy me, because I felt as if there was a very smart strategy to have a content aggregation strategy and to call it one thing. I mean, you know, we were just a little bit ahead of our game, and Paul and Walter were so savvy about this, but we still couldn't quite figure out how to monetize it. And we had, you know, over 100 people, and so there were some real expenses there, and we had a lot of servers, and the pipes kept growing, and it got ahead of us in terms of our ability to say, here's the business model for Pathfinder.
No, I think that let's cycle back on that for just a second. I mean, that's a good point, that it's obviously, it's a portal in 94, so it's way before a lot of things, and, you know, 3 or 4 years later, portals are the things that really make Wall Street excited. But is it, so the original motivation for going under one umbrella, one brand, Pathfinder, was that would make it easier to consolidate as one property for the purposes of advertising and stuff?
I believe that was always the intent, is that essentially you could say, hey, we have an audience of, I mean, these are not sophisticated days where you could segregate your audience and sell certain audiences across your website. So we were just trying to get enough critical mass to be able to sell advertising against it. So that was the only reason for the consolidation of, as far as I was concerned, of why you'd call something Pathfinder. And you know, we didn't, you know, SI was on the sidelines. They had not gone in, and they had struck a deal with CNN to do some things. So we were building some, you know, stuff around the edges. People was a little late to come in because they're a little bit more protective of their brand. So we didn't have, you know, we had gardening sites and we had news sites, and, you know, we had a lot of sort of interesting stuff, but not, you know, and plenty of traffic, but probably, you know, could we, you know, if we had been, you know, in hindsight, you know, should we have had the times, the fortunes, the monies, the you know, all of those, you know, aggregated into different, you know, sections and really smart about it, we probably never got to that point where we could really strategize about, okay, we're going to really create a front page and then drive people into, and we did have a front page and we did have a quite nice front page, but it wasn't as if we were selling different audiences against that or anything like that. But I think the whole intent of Pathfinder was audience aggregation to monetize versus advertising. I don't remember, and I could be wrong, that there was any idea that we were going to charge for the content.
So can we talk also about, you know, a lot of it is content that you're bringing over from print and putting on the web, but let's talk some about some of the organic stuff that Pathfinder itself is doing. Things like, you know, the OJ Central or the Netly News and things like that.
Yeah, so I think that we started, some of the great, Chris Peacock and some of these folks at some of the brands decided to build some extensions of those brands, whether they were tied to it or not. But we started building a lot of sort of interesting extensions. The OJ Central was what it was, but it was just a great news site. Interesting news site, but probably if you think about it, we probably would never be able to sell a stick of advertising against it. And we just started experimenting. We really made it a test bed for brand extensions, new ideas, and we had a ton of creative engineers so that they could write. Early days of writing, web pages and code and came up with some interesting ideas. But what eventually happened is, we had McKinsey come in and Don Logan was trying to figure out what the heck to do with this thing. And so they came in and then we started, I can't remember if Paul had decided to take a sabbatical or leave. He eventually ended up as the present CEO of Akamai, but he took a year leave and Dan Okren came in and we brought Dan Okren came in to be the sort of the CEO of the organization. And he has a very strong, obviously, editorial background. And so with McKinsey, they started to look at, okay, how much traffic are you getting? How many people are you working on? And really giving it putting it through an appropriate lens of what are you doing here? And we found out that there was probably only five sections in the whole site that were, had enough traffic to drive any kind of business model. And that was sort of the beginning of the end where we decided that, I think Dan called it five fucking flowers or something, pardon the French, but he was really about driving the business down to sort of its core essence and be more brand focused.
Not that you would, obviously off the top of your head be able to remember them all, but do you kind of remember what some of those more successful sections were?
Time, people, I know we had a gardening one that was not successful. I can't off the top of my head. I'll have to go back and ask some peers. At that point, I think was sort of where we then decide, let's break this all apart and push it back to the properties. And I subsequently went to SI and worked on SI.com and became the general manager at Sports Illustrated for a number of years. But it was a wild ride for about 7 years of my life, for 6 years of my life, where we essentially went from building nothing to building this incredible portal to bringing it up and then taking it all the way back down and getting a lot of heat for what we were doing in the middle.
Right. At the risk of asking a leading question, again, cycling back to the idea that, you guys created a portal that eventually portals became the watchword. It feels to me like the problem maybe was that, a Yahoo has the flexibility to say, all right, we can lose money quarter after quarter after quarter because we're raising VC money, we're doing IPOs, so we've got cash to burn through before we can finally turn the corner on profitability. And you guys maybe always had, over your shoulder people saying, when is this going to turn into the black and stuff like that? Is maybe the problem like this was too entrepreneurial, too experimental a project to have a chance to succeed inside an organization like Time Warner?
Yeah, I think you're spot on. I think one is, Don had a great run of 40 quarters of growth, and I think there was a lot of pressure to keep sustaining that was the first thing. Second is, this was completely different than what the magazine world knew. And I think they didn't quite get it. They didn't quite appreciate what they had. And there was almost this, look at those guys over there just burning all this cash and And, you know, this is, of course, before the Time Warner days where Time Inc. is sending all sorts of cash over to Time Warner Corporate. But, you know, what the heck is going on over there? And I also think that, you know, some of the things you see now in terms of print, you know, newspapers and trying to make a transition to digital, it's very hard. And the thinking, the sort of the DNA is not the same. And so we brought in a lot of young, interesting people that were just so foreign to the culture of the Time Inc., you know, sort of blue chip ethos that it didn't quite, we couldn't quite ever push it over the edge in terms of, like, you know, if you're spending $100 million, you should probably spend $500 million to really get this thing launched. And right. And we were definitely under a lot of pressure to manage our costs. There's always that kind of worry. So I think you're absolutely right. There was a period of time where we sort of had a grace period, but then once it sort of tipped over, you know, I don't know, but, you know, Don talked about this $100 million black hole. He was skeptical of a sales model, and he was skeptical that we would ever get this thing into the black. And so he, I think, started asking a lot of hard questions about it that were probably appropriate. But, you know, for us, you know, in hindsight, we feels like, Jesus, could we have become a Yahoo? Could we have become, you know, a very, very large content portal, not a technology portal, a content portal? And could we have leveraged that? And, you know, I still ask myself that, you know, 25 years later, but it's not a lot of use in it. But I think it was a fun ride, and it was really an interesting time.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Well, sort of in summation, I've been asking every Time Warner person, it's fascinating to me that Time Warner, of all of the media companies on the landscape at this point, was experimenting in technology before anyone else. I mean, Pathfinder launches exactly concurrently with Yahoo. So, you know, there's a time when the big content plays on the web are Pathfinder, Hotwired, and Yahoo, essentially. Why was it Time Warner that was so far out ahead in this experimenting with technology?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I think part of what led us was not so much that it was not the Time Inc. side, it was the Time Warner side. There was the Warner side, essentially. And I think it was the cable side that actually got us down this road. And, you know, when we were building, and the insights of some very brilliant people, I mean, Walter Isaacson, you know, just had this vision, and, you know, he went on to lead CNN and now runs the Ask, and he's a, you know, and written the Jobs book and everything. So he clearly was an early adopter, got it. And he just was ferocious in driving this thing, at least to get it to a place where it could be evaluated on, you know, as a business proposition. And I don't think it ever, you know, we were probably a little bit, and, you know, we had bottom line numbers that probably the Yahoos and the Hotwires of the world didn't have to worry about. So that may have hurt us in the long run. But I do think that, you know, Jerry Levin was trying to get this TV station started, and, you know, Time Warner Cable ultimately built put a lot of fiber in the ground on the backs of Time Inc. And so I think that, it was just sort of serendipitous that the right guys were at the right place to do this test. And I'm one of these guys that always thinks, at one point, Sports Illustrated could have bought ESPN, and people gnash their teeth over that. And I'm saying, I'm just not sure a magazine company could have really pulled off an ESPN and made it what it is. And I sort of think maybe it's the same truth for Pathfinder. I'm just not sure ultimately that a magazine company had the right DNA to become, a huge internet giant. Ultimately we became that, and, AOL, and for all the wrong reasons. But I think that there's probably something in sort of the people and the culture that drives some of these things. So we have very smart people who initiated the concept, and probably the culture killed us ultimately. And being a publicly traded company got in our way in these early days.
Well, Oliver, thank you. Thanks for remembering all this for us.
Sure. It's fun to reminisce. I hope you found it a little bit interesting.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Sure. Take care.
If you're enjoying this podcast, there's one simple thing that you can do to help us out. If you do nothing else, just go to iTunes and rate us. 1 to 5 stars takes about 2 seconds. Or give us a review, because the weird way that iTunes works is it's not just the number of downloads, it's also the number of ratings and reviews. As always, you can join the conversation at www.internethistorypodcast.com. Get more info, see pictures, and see my full bibliography for each episode. The show's Twitter is @NetHistoryPod, and my personal Twitter is @BrianMCC. Thanks for listening.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.